When we look at it, at the universe, there's an incredible amount that's out there for us to see. Here in our own Milky Way, we have the sun, the planets of the solar system, then we have a slew of other stars, billions upon billions of them, all of which have their own star systems. We have gas, we have dust, we have black holes, including a supermassive one at the center of our galaxy. But also, well beyond the limits of our observations, there are signals coming from the distant universe. We have the leftover background of light from the Big Bang, the cosmic microwave background. We have particles streaming through space from neutrinos to electrons to protons and heavier nuclei, cosmic rays. And we also have gravitational waves rippling all throughout space-time and sending signals that propagate at the speed of light. Very excitingly, earlier this year, for the very first time, we actually detected this cosmic gravitational wave background itself. I'm so excited to focus on this. How did we do it? What is it teaching us? And where do we go from here? Find out on this edition of the Starts With a Bang podcast. Any mass that moves through a curved region of space-time is going to emit gravitational waves. We first detected these back in 2015 when the LIGO Gravitational Wave Observatory saw the signals from two black holes in the final stages of an in-spiral and merger. But now, we're seeing gravitational waves that aren't from any one individual source like that, but rather from gravitational waves that are generated all throughout the universe. We're seeing this giant cosmic ocean of a signal rippling past us all throughout the galaxy. And here to guide us through this science and take us deep into the weeds, I'm so pleased to welcome to the program Dr. Thankful Cromarty. Dr. Cromarty is an Einstein postdoctoral fellow at Cornell University and is an expert in neutron stars, pulsars, and the gravitational wave signals that we can use networks of them to detect. Thankful, I'm so happy that you're here and welcome to the program.
It's so wonderful to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
No, I'm really excited about this. You know, I've talked to people from NanoGrav and other pulsar timing projects before, and this is the first time that I get to talk to someone where we have much, much more than limits or potential to talk about. We have a real signal to talk about, and this is like a remarkable moment for me. I remember when we detected gravitational waves with LIGO for the very first time, and I thought, wow, this is revolutionary. This is like a moment that must be like what Galileo might have felt when he looked through the telescope for the first time and saw moons around Jupiter and the phases of Venus. And here we are, looking at the universe in this entirely new type of signal in gravitational waves. Now, we're using an entirely different method. Instead of looking at these very, very short period signals that are generated in these final millisecond timescale environments where black holes are inspiraling and merging, we're instead seeing this giant cosmic hum from all of the masses throughout the universe that are revolving around one another with timescales of like a year to a decade. What does it mean to you that we finally have seen this cosmic signal, what some are calling this cosmic hum to the universe?
Well, I think it's, you know, enormously exciting that we're starting to be able to show evidence for this gravitational wave background. Something inherent to our signal is just that it takes decades to build up our sensitivity, right? Because this is happening on very different timescales, like you just said, than something like the LIGO collaboration can see. And so it's really a testament to the sort of patience and hard work that so many people who are, you know, part of pulsar timing array experiments just have put in over literally more than a decade and a half, and several decades, depending on the collaboration that you're talking about. And so it's really exciting to see. You know, I get so excited about the science that we do because I love pulsars, and, you know, I'm sure we'll talk about this, but just the fact that we can use pulsars to probe this stochastic gravitational wave background is kind of mind-blowing to me. It's a really cool sort of experiment where our detector is actually in space, and just to see sort of this evidence that we've been presenting in the papers we published in June, it really means a lot. Obviously, we've been working our butts off, but I don't know. I think it's just so cool.
I mean, this is one of those things that I think if we thought hard enough about it, we'd have known this has to be there, right? If Einstein's theory of gravity is correct, and so far under pretty much every astrophysical situation where we've explored it in depth, boy, it sure does look consistent with what we've seen from solar system scales to galaxy scales to galaxy cluster scales to cosmic scales. Einstein's theories really passed with flying colors every test we've thrown at it. But one of the interesting predictions it makes is that basically if I have any mass anywhere in the universe, that mass is going to curve the space-time around it. It'll technically curve space-time everywhere, but the biggest effects will be closest to that mass in its own vicinity, which means anytime you have something orbiting that mass, that is not going to be a stable elliptical orbit like Newton would have taught you. No, any two masses that orbit one another under the power of their own gravity are instead going to decay. I think if you said, let's make the sun and Earth perfectly stable, and let's take the rest of the solar system away, and let's never have the sun die or lose mass, let's just have Earth orbit it and orbit it and orbit it, I think after about 10 to the 26 years, Earth's orbit would decay completely until it fell into the sun. And that's all because of gravitational waves. So how does that sort of way of thinking lead us to expect that there would be a cosmic gravitational wave background out there?
Right. So, you know, people have been thinking about this. Obviously, what we're seeing is consistent with Einstein's predictions. And so in that way, exactly as you said, every single test we've thrown at the theory of GR has been pretty supportive of what Einstein originally predicted, which is sort of amazing in its own way. But yeah, this background is sort of expected because we know that these supermassive black holes are at the centers of galaxies, right? That's something that's been predicted for a long time. And we know that galaxies do sort of grow through merging over cosmic time. And even though the process takes millions and millions of years and we can't observe it directly, we do know that as they circle each other and as they decay, and start forming sort of larger and larger galaxies, it's going to produce a very strong gravitational wave signal, because that's what happens when you have masses accelerating through space-time, right? And so sort of on some level, you would expect to see it, but there are a lot of things that we still don't know about kind of the distribution of all of these galaxies all over the universe, right? The signal will be impacted by sort of how massive the galaxies are, exactly how mergers proceed. So that's something that we can't watch over a lifetime, but that we can sort of probe through these gravitational wave experiments. And so the signal, whatever the signal looks like, is going to be very influenced by sort of how much these black holes are interacting with their environments and exactly how the mergers go through and how they lose energy. And so there are some unknowns, things like how circular the in spirals are will affect what the signal looks like. And so there are definitely a lot of outstanding questions. But yeah, I think on sort of an intuitive level, we know that these mergers are happening all over the universe. We're not claiming that, you know, because of this evidence that we've presented, that we know it's coming from supermassive black hole binary mergers, which is sort of a funny point. But we certainly do think that what we're seeing is consistent with that signal that would come from all of those merging galaxies. And so it kind of makes sense on an intuitive level, but we still have a whole lot to learn exactly about what's going on with the astrophysics of these galaxy mergers.
Well, I mean, that's an interesting point you bring up, because I can imagine lots of different sources that would produce gravitational waves. You know, for example, I can say, well, there have to be just enormous numbers somewhere in the sextillions of stars throughout the universe. And many of these stars are going to have planets that orbit them on 1 to 10 year periods. Many of them are going to have binary companions, other stars that orbit them with 1 to 10 year periods. And I'm also going to have, as you say, these much more massive objects, stellar mass black holes, intermediate mass black holes, and even supermassive and ultramassive black holes that are, you know, anywhere from tens to hundreds to thousands to millions to even several billion solar masses. And they're all going to have objects that orbit them as well. Can I ask you, why is it when we think about all these different types of masses that are out there and all these different types of masses that orbit these masses out there, why do we think it should be the supermassive black holes that orbit one another, again, the ones that orbit with periods of around 1 to 10 years, that should be easiest to detect? Why should that be the largest signal as opposed to all the stars with planets around them, or all the stars with other stars orbiting them, or all of the things that orbit, you know, these smaller black holes? Why is it the supermassive black holes? And specifically, I believe you said it's the supermassive black hole pairs, what we call supermassive black hole binaries, that we expect to result whenever you have two big enough galaxies merging together. Why do we think it's supermassive black hole binaries that should produce the largest gravitational wave signals?
Yeah, so all of these different kinds of gravitational wave producing events that you're talking about are going to have sort of unique profiles based on the objects that are doing the moving, right? Doing the creation of gravitational waves. And so pulsar timing ray experiments are sensitive to very, very kind of high strain signals, those signals that are causing a lot of deformation of space-time, that have much lower frequencies. And so we know that the merging supermassive black holes are going to create a relatively loud signal, but one that is at very low frequencies. When you're talking about sort of sensitivity, or you're talking about what we can actually see and what sorts of objects those come from, it's totally a function of what experiment you're talking about. So for something like NanoGrav, we're looking at high strain events, but ones at low frequencies. And so that's where our sensitivity lies. And the reason for that is basically that we are looking over a very long time span when we do our data analysis. So, you know, our most recent papers are based on 15 years of data, and that's sort of what we've needed to build up the sensitivity to these supermassive black hole binary mergers. But when you're talking about, and the other important thing is that our experiment, our instrument, so sort of what you would think of like LIGO's interferometers, right? It's actually galactic scale. And so the distance between all of our sort of test masses, or whatever you want to call them, which are our pulsars, are extremely large compared to other experiments. So something like LIGO, the arms of their interferometer are sort of on very terrestrial scales, right? Sort of city-sized scales or smaller. LISA falls somewhere in the middle of pulsar timing ray experiments and ground-based gravitational wave experiments like LIGO. And for that reason, all of these kinds of experiments are very complementary in the kinds of events that they're sensitive to. And so, you know, LIGO and LISA can probe much smaller characteristic strains, but at much higher frequencies. And that's just because of the size of the experiment and how long it takes to sort of see one of those signals. And so, you know, nanographs and other PTA experiments' status as these galactic scale detectors is really what makes us sensitive to those high strain, low frequency events.
I see. So if I were to think about this, I know we use the word strain to talk about it, but I think of strain as basically this is the amplitude of my signal. This is how big are the space-time ripples that are happening from these events that are happening. And what you're saying is, listen, if you had a detector like LIGO with these very short, very, very sensitive laser arms that are happening here on Earth, you know, yeah, you can measure things that happen with very, very low amplitudes, these very low strains, but they happen quickly. They happen with these very short period signals, right? You're seeing the inspirals and mergers of these black holes where an entire orbit of one black hole around the other happens in just a fraction of a second, happens on the time period of milliseconds. So yeah, you're seeing a low strain, but you're seeing it at a very fast frequency. You're seeing it with a very short period. As you go to longer and longer baseline arms, this is good because space is less curved the farther away you are from a mass, even a big mass. But that's okay. You can up the mass. You can get a bigger strain, a bigger amplitude for your signal. So LISA, which hopefully will launch in a few years and will be our laser interferometer space antenna, will be able to see more massive things that happen on longer time periods than LIGO can see, even though LISA will have less strain sensitivity, right? You'll be able to see things with a bigger strain with LISA, whereas you can see things all the way down to a smaller strain with LIGO. You're saying if I use pulsars, these natural clocks of the universe that we will, I promise, talk more about later, that, yeah, these pulsars are located all throughout the galaxy. We're talking about pulsars that are hundreds, thousands, even 10,000 plus light years away in our own galaxy. And so now we're talking about these huge amplitude signals that are generated by supermassive black holes orbiting other supermassive black holes. You can't get those kinds of huge masses and huge strains for LIGO or LISA, but the trade-off is they happen on much longer timescales, so you need basically years of data to see them. And if I'm reading what you're telling me correctly, it's that, yeah, Ethan, all those other signals you talked about, planets orbiting stars, stars orbiting stars, wide black hole binaries, all of these things, yeah, they produce those same frequency signals that the supermassive black hole binary produces, but the supermassive black hole binaries dominate the strain. They dominate the amplitude. They're of the right mass and the right distance that when we look at the universe on 1 to 10 year period timescales, this is what we expect is making the biggest amplitude gravitational wave signals. Do we have that right?
Yep, that's exactly correct.
That's awesome.
And the funny complicating factor, though, and I was a little bit cagey with my language before, because with this recent nanograv result and with the results from our colleagues in other pulsar timing array experiments around the world, there's actually, you know, what we're seeing is consistent with a stochastic background from supermassive black hole binary mergers. But there's actually nothing that we can say right now that is definitive. We can't say we know that the signal is 100% coming from these types of events. And in fact, there are some interesting sort of beyond the standard model of physics phenomena, and especially things that happened even closer to the Big Bang than when the cosmic microwave background was cemented. There are some very interesting exotic phenomena that would have imprinted a signal in, you know, in this sort of pervasive universe-wide gravitational wave signal that could be in our band of sensitivity, in the range of sensitivity that pulsar time and array experiments have. And so there's some really interesting interpretation where you can say, well, okay, if this isn't a background of gravitational waves from binary supermassive black hole mergers, what exotic phenomena could also be consistent with the signal that we see? And these are things like early universe phase transitions and cosmic strings and all kinds of sort of mind-blowing, interesting things. Obviously, we think the most likely explanation is that it's coming from this background of supermassive black hole mergers that are happening when galaxies merge and grow. But we can't claim that 100%.
You know, I think that's an important thing to remember, right? Because when we go about science, right, I default to being very conservative as a scientist, which is to say, when I think about what's out there in the universe, I assume the minimum number of new things possible. Okay, if we're talking cosmology, there's dark matter and dark energy and inflation to set up the hot Big Bang. But after that, I don't like to assume anything else that doesn't have observational support. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't keep it in mind. If you had topological defects that the universe was born with, like cosmic strings or domain walls or cosmic textures or whatever your favorite topological defect is, if those then decayed early on, the decay of those exotic things would produce a gravitational wave signal, and it would look different than a stochastic background of merging supermassive black hole binaries. If you had a large amplitude signal generated from cosmic inflation, this gravitational wave background whose spectrum is well predicted by inflation, but whose amplitude is not constrained at all, that could, in some scenarios, outwave the ripples in space-time. Like, that could outwave the stochastic supermassive black hole binary background. So I think it's important to recognize that there's a big difference here between what we've actually done, which is detect the presence of this background, which in itself I still think is an absolutely remarkable achievement, versus characterizing the background. And I know you've been able with your current work to say, okay, we've been able to show that it isn't this variety of gravitational waves from inflation, and perhaps we can say that these certain theoretical models of non-stochastic supermassive black hole binary, like something other than that, we can rule some of those out. But largely, this background remains uncharacterized. And I think it's important to sort of recognize that that's where we are today, that we have taken the remarkable step of detecting the background, but characterizing the background is going to take future work, which includes longer baselines of observations, more continued observation of these pulsars with, you know, the same sort of frequency monitoring, where you want to observe many different pulsars in the same frequency bands, ideally with the same instruments, and also better instruments to sort of measure these universe's natural clocks as precisely as possible over very long periods of time. Do you foresee that characterizing this background is within the realm of possibility for near future science? Is this something that you think, with continued pulsar timing monitoring, we should be able to at last characterize this background and say it is consistent with the stochastic gravitational wave background from supermassive black hole binaries and not from any of these other exotic sources or inflation?
Totally. Yeah. So I think that you know, I tend to be like you described you were, a little bit conservative about these sorts of things. But I think that this sort of unknown leaves open a lot of excitement, right? This is really the beginning for pulsar timing array experiments. This is not kind of like a, we did it, we're done now sort of thing. This is really an opportunity to get a lot of fantastic science in this brand new way going forward. And so you're totally right. As we continue to do our monitoring of our pulsars, do our observations, do these more advanced analyses, we're only going to have a better and better idea of what exactly the signal is coming from, what it looks like spectrally, right? The shape of the gravitational wave spectrum at these low frequencies that we're sensitive to is going to tell us a ton about how galaxy mergers proceed. It's going to let us sort of say whether or not we think we're seeing some of these beyond the standard model proposals. And so you're exactly right in that. And so I'm really excited about what we're going to be seeing on the sort of 5 to 10 year timescale. One thing that we do expect to see are what we call continuous wave signals. And so these are individual supermassive black hole binary mergers that we will gain sensitivity to with time, but that we don't have sensitivity to necessarily right now. And that just requires us to keep on keeping on, right, with our observing program. And so once we start learning about, you know, whether the background is actually anisotropic, that's one search that was done on these data and other data sets that can maybe help distinguish some of these theories between the beyond the standard model, the sort of alternative astrophysics theories, rather than the stochastic background being from just mergers of supermassive binary black holes. Looking for anisotropy in the background is going to be a really good way to distinguish those two sorts of categories of theories. Being able to see these single mergers, these continuous wave signals, is also going to be really, really exciting. And it's going to kind of open the door for multi-messenger astrophysics and all kinds of cool stuff. It's very interesting from, you know, an observer's perspective, because I very much am an observer, just to think about how we can kind of tune our pulsar timing array to gain sensitivity to those kinds of signals. And so that's something we're going to be thinking about going forward. But you also mentioned, you know, new instruments and sort of this exciting sort of frontier for radio observations of pulsars. We're really excited about some of the new projects that are being developed and coming online. Things like the DSA 2000, Deep Synoptic Array 2000. It's a 2000 element interferometer radio, obviously, that's been proposed and is sort of in the development stages. But NanoGrab would be able to use a big chunk of on sky time for that array. And so that would really help us with gaining sensitivity to these individual merger events, and just gaining sensitivity to sort of the background itself and being able to better characterize the signal at a wider range of frequencies, which we'll be able to do over time. And so I think that the possibilities are just sort of endless, and it's a really exciting beginning for our field and definitely not an ending by any means.
No, that's really wonderful. I'd like to pause for a minute and thank our sponsor. You're listening to Starts with a Bang with your host, Ethan Siegel, and our guest, Dr. Thankful Cromarty. Today's episode is brought to you by Avenues Online, the virtual campus of Avenues The World School. Avenues Online is an accredited Tier 1 private school designed for students from toddler through 12th grade who want to pursue a world-class education freed from the constraints of a physical school. Learn alongside peers living on 6 continents and in more than 20 countries with a global faculty leading the way. Learn more at avenues.org/SWAB. And now, back to our program. So, Thankful, I'm really excited about this possibility that you brought up, where you're saying, listen, we are currently able to detect there's something out there, but we have new instruments coming online where we suspect that in the very near future, we're going to be able to see, oh, no, no, no. It's not just like the background hum of all of the individual supermassive black holes that are orbiting one another that we're able to detect. We're actually going to be able to say, oh, look at that. You can tell right now that there's a pair of supermassive or ultramassive black holes orbiting one another, and it's over there in the sky, and we can detect where it is. We can detect the individual waves from it. It's sort of like, I think about it like being in a pool, or maybe even something bigger than a pool, like an ocean. If you're in the ocean, you know, yeah, there are ocean waves coming from everything. But if there's an enormous, fast-moving, massive ship that goes by, when those waves pass by you, if you're close enough to it, you're going to be able to tell, oh, that wave came from that ship, and there's this series of waves coming from that ship. And, oh, look, there was this enormous splash and this new thing, and that must have been a blue whale. Nothing but a blue whale could have made waves this big and with this frequency. Is that sort of what you think we're going to be able to do with near future technology as far as supermassive black hole binaries are concerned? And if so, what is so remarkable about this new set of observatories that are gonna improve our ability to measure these objects?
Yeah, so I love that analogy. It's very fun to think about, if not a little bit scary to think about, almost getting run over by a giant ship or a whale. But that's exactly right. There are going to be these more sort of booming individual signals that we will gain sensitivity to. And the whole thing about the new facilities is that they're going to, you know, increase the amount of observing time we have. That's sort of a practical concern, but it really is an important one. They're also going to let us time our pulsars more precisely. So how well we can kind of measure the time of arrival of all the pulses, all these kind of clock ticks that we get from our pulsars, that really impacts sort of our ability to make a great detection as well. The number of pulsars that we time is actually, in terms of detecting at least the stochastic background, sort of in the regime that we're in right now, that's the most important thing, is the number of pulsars that we time. That's linearly correlated with the sensitivity we have to the gravitational wave background. So that plus the amount of time that we observe, plus how well we can time our pulsars, those are the factors that really make a difference. And so with new observatories coming online, you know, we're excited about DSA 2000, we're excited about the NGVLA, we're excited about the SKA and all of these other amazing observatories that are sort of in the works right now. All of those are going to help us gain sensitivity in a really serious way. And so the other thing is just patience, which sounds a bit boring, but it really is the case. We just have to wait because our sensitivity to the signal is going to build up with time. And so in order to see these individual events, in order to better characterize the background, we do just have to have a little bit of patience, and we have to keep doing exactly what we're doing, but do it more and do it better. So yeah, we're just going to keep at it. That's kind of what we have to do.
You know, I really like the way you talked about this. The three projects that you talked about, the SKA, the NGVLA, which is the next generation successor to the Very Large Array, and I know was the number one recommendation for all of ground-based astronomy and radio astronomy made by the Decadal Survey for the 2020s. Like, this was the highest priority thing we could build. And I'm sorry that I'm not familiar with the first one that you mentioned. Can you remind us, and me too, what that one is as well?
Yeah, so that's the DSA 2000. It is a 2000 element interferometer that's going to operate at frequencies that are fantastic for a whole lot of things, including transients, and it's going to open up possibilities for multi-messenger astrophysics as well, but also for pulsar timing. It's really right in the frequency regime that we need. And so being able to use an instrument like that is going to be enormously helpful too. But yeah, all of these next generation sort of proposals and things that are in the works are going to be just extremely impactful.
You know, that's remarkable to me. But one of the things that strikes me about this is you're talking about arrays of telescopes. You know, I come from sort of an older generation where we learned that what's really important in radio astronomy is the overall size of your dish, is that overall collecting area. And so, you know, an observatory like at Arecibo was sort of looked at as like, that's what you really want, is you want a big giant dish, and that's how you monitor things really well. I think that, you know, with the Very Large Array and especially with ALMA in the Southern Hemisphere, we've seen the power of arrays. But I wanted to ask you if there's anything that by focusing on building these arrays that we're missing by not having very large individual dishes as sort of a complement to those, or does that matter less when it comes to pulsar timing?
Yeah, so that's a fantastic question. And I'm actually totally with you in this thinking of radio telescopes are big light buckets, right? And so the thing we really want is just a giant collecting area. And the sort of funny thing here is that for pulsar timing, generally speaking, that's all we care about. We don't need the fantastic angular resolution or anything like that. And so we are a little bit agnostic about this question of interferometers versus single dish telescopes. We just want to make sure that these interferometers that we're using have a lot of dishes so that we really are building up that signal. We're getting that giant light bucket. But pulsar timing really doesn't require that sort of instrumentation. We really want a big light bucket. Like we were very dependent on Arecibo, and I could talk for hours about Arecibo. It was an incredible instrument and very important on, you know, personal and scientific levels. But an Arecibo is exactly what we want. And so that accounted for about half of our sensitivity to the background. And so after losing Arecibo, we really had to kind of scramble to change our observing program. But yeah, we're not totally partial to you know, interferometers or anything like that. It really has to do, I think, with the idea that these instruments have to serve a lot of the community, right? And so we're not just building sort of a pulsar timing instrument, because that would look very different, maybe. We're building an instrument that can do lots of different kinds of astrophysics, and so it has to serve many, many members of the community. So you're totally right about that. I mean, we don't care too much, but big light buckets are good.
Yeah, that's kind of interesting to sort of hear you say, you know, well, listen, these are general purpose observatories that you get with arrays, and they're great because they're Swiss Army knives. And look at all the different things you can do with them and all the different types of radio astronomy you can do with them. But also, I'm doing pulsar timing. I just want a big sharp knife, and the Swiss Army knife I'll make do with, but boy, if I could have a real big sharp knife and a real big light bucket, that would be a game changer for us. And I think losing Arecibo has been a game changer in a negative direction that I think a lot of people in the general public don't appreciate. You threw out a statistic that actually surprised me to hear about it, and I'm the one who brought it up, that about half of your reduction in the sensitivity to other background sources came from that one observatory, came from Arecibo. Even now, with all the good telescopes and telescope arrays and radio dishes that we do have monitoring these objects, do you sort of feel the loss when you analyze the data that you're getting now and say, wow, if we had an Arecibo type or Arecibo quality or Arecibo sized radio dish, this data would tell us so much more than what we're actually able to get out of it?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. And we're actually not at the point of feeling that loss scientifically quite yet. So the data release that we just put out that contains more than 15 years of data actually ends, the Arecibo part of the data set ends right when it became non-functional, right when there was a cable break and we couldn't observe anymore. And so this data set is not quite reflecting that loss yet, but future data sets will. And so what we had to do right when we stopped being able to use Arecibo was restructure the observing program. And, you know, I don't have to go into all the specifics of this, but I can talk about it a little bit. The Green Bank Telescope is the other major observatory that we were using for most of our history as NanoGov. And so we get, you know, quite a lot of time on the Green Bank Telescope, which we're enormously grateful for. That is 100, you know, for those of you who might not be familiar with Green Bank, it's a 100 meter diameter radio telescope. It's fully steerable. It's this very beautiful instrument. But we were able to move some of the pulsars, you know, move most of the pulsars that we were timing at Arecibo to Green Bank, because the declination range for Arecibo fits inside of that for Green Bank. And so we did some more in the weeds kind of moving around pulsars in terms of which observing frequencies we were timing them at. We also got really lucky in that we started to be able to use the Canadian Hydrogen Intensity Mapping Experiment, CHIME. And so that is a telescope where we can observe all of our pulsar, or a subset. It's a subset of pulsars because it doesn't have quite the same view of the sky that the GBT does. But 53 of the, you know, 80-ish pulsars that we're timing right now, we can see with CHIME, and we get daily observations with that telescope of those 53 pulsars. And one of the cool things about CHIME is that it has a much lower observing frequency, and so it has receivers that are sensitive from 400 to 800 megahertz. And so a lot of the pulsars that we were timing at the Green Bank telescope at 820 megahertz, we were able to move to CHIME. And so CHIME really kind of saved us a little bit in recovering some of that observing sensitivity. And so, we're feeling the loss of Arecibo in a whole, you know, many, many different ways. And I think that we absolutely will start to notice it once we're analyzing the data that comes after the Arecibo era. But we're also grateful that we've had access to resources that have let us kind of restructure and regain most of our sensitivity back. And so it's sort of where we're sitting now. It's not, it's not spelling sort of the end of NanoGrav or anything like that. But we absolutely do miss being able to use that incredible telescope. It was really one of a kind, and it meant a lot to us. So it's definitely difficult, but we've done what we can.
No, and I think that's really important. You know, one of the themes that keeps coming up on this podcast over and over is how astronomy and astrophysics is really a global endeavor. And, you know, I think, you know, it's important to mention that, you know, even though the NanoGrav collaboration was able to say, hey, we detected this gravitational wave hum of the universe, we detected these ripples in space-time that are going all throughout the galaxy, NanoGrav, the North American Nanohertz Observatory, is not the only place doing this pulsar timing. There's the Parkes pulsar timing array in Australia. There's the European pulsar timing array. There is the Chinese version of it, which, if I remember right, they only had about 3 years of data, but they were able to come up with an extremely statistically significant, I think out of all of the collaborations, they were closest to reaching the 5 sigma threshold for detection of this signal. And I think that's largely in part due to the relatively new radio telescope they built that not too long ago surpassed Arecibo as the world's largest radio telescope. So I think it's really important to note that in the future, even with the loss of Arecibo, what we call the International Pulsar Timing Array, which is sort of like all the different regional pulsar timing collaborations synthesizing their results together, that's going to be less affected by the loss of one major observatory because there are partners in the scientific investigation working on this same problem from all over the world.
Yeah, that's totally correct. And I could go on and on about how excited I am about what the IPTA is doing. The first thing I will say, it's a bit of an annoying point, but NanoGrav is not claiming a detection of gravitational waves, right? We're saying we have strong evidence for it, and that's semantic, but I feel the need to be very clear about it. But yeah, I mean, we have been working with our international partners in Europe, in Australia, in China, in South Africa with the MIR time array, in India with the Indian pulsar timing array. All of these collaborations are doing incredible work. We all have access to different phenomenal instruments to do this pulsar timing. And so you're exactly right that, you know, the loss of observing capabilities in one part of the observing program is not necessarily going to, it's going to maybe pale in comparison to what we can do with a larger combined data set. And so you're correct about our colleagues having released their results as well simultaneously. This was a big coordinated effort over many, many months and years. And so check out their papers as well, because they're doing great work, seeing a very similar signal that totally everyone's in agreement with the sort of idea that we're starting to see this gravitational wave background. So that's one thing that's really reassuring as well, is we're not completely independent, but we're effectively independent in doing our data analysis. We're using different instruments. We're using even different pulsar timing software packages, noise analysis packages, things like that. And so the fact that we're all doing this in slightly different ways, but we're able to see a very similar result in our data sets is just awesome. That's fantastic. The case with the Chinese pulsar timing arrays results, you're right that it's a little bit different. So they have a much shorter data span that, you know, they've been not timing their pulsars for quite as long because FAST is a relatively new instrument. But they, you know, FAST is a very sensitive instrument and they're able to time their pulsars with a pretty high cadence. I will say that those data are not currently being combined as part of the International Pulsar Timing Array. They have what we call observer status, and we're really hoping that we can all get together and sort of talk about exactly how our data analysis happened. And so I think that it's all good news on the international front. We're really working hard right now on what's called the third, we're calling it DR3. It's the third data release from the International Pulsar Timing Array. And the idea here is that we're combining data from all these different collaborations, right? This is North America, Europe, Australia, India, South Africa. We're all coming together and sort of combining our data in this process that's, honestly, it's really non-trivial. It's a really hard thing to do, but we know that it's very worthwhile because it's really going to increase our sensitivity to gravitational waves. And so we're working hard on this and putting into, you know, putting together a bit of infrastructure that's going to help us do this more efficiently going forward. And there's a ton of very in the weeds stuff happening. But I'm really excited about it. And I think lots of people in the IPTA are really sort of, they can't wait to see what we might be able to see with a combined data set. So it's really good stuff.
No, and I will say to all of our listeners, Thankful is being very smart by hedging appropriately and saying, listen, this is the statistical significance of our signal. It's quite significant, and it's in agreement with other quite significant signals that other collaborations have said. But us with our data on our own, we have not crossed what we typically rate as the gold standard to say we've discovered this or we've detected this, and therefore we're only saying we've found evidence for it. But I'm not in the collaboration generation, and I have no such problem saying I would be absolutely shocked if, when all of these different pulsar timing arrays had their data combined, analyzed together, synthesized together, I would be absolutely shocked if that gold standard for discovery wasn't crossed at that time. I'm very much expecting that when the International Pulsar Timing Array does their next data release, what you're calling DR3, that we will in fact have that vaunted robust detection that you're looking for. And you can comment on it if you like, but you don't have to.
Yeah, I'll try to be as politically smart as I can be and just say, of course, this brings up some interesting questions about this sort of five sigma gold standard and all of that. But we are confident in the evidence that we're seeing. I'm really excited to see what's going to happen on this sort of 5 to 10 year timescale that I talked about. And I'm also really excited to see what's going to come out of DR3 from the IPTA. So I think that that's probably where I should stop talking. But I agree that it's an exciting time.
Yeah, I have a little more leeway and freedom to speculate than you do, which is a little unfortunate because you have more knowledge than I do. But our listeners will have to live with that. What I'd really love to do, though, is switch gears a little bit, because there are a lot of people who work on pulsar timing arrays. There are a lot of people who work on sort of the problem of the gravitational wave background of the universe. You come at this from an observer's perspective, and as an observer who is a specialist in these objects themselves, in the neutron stars that pulsars all make up. And if it would be all right, I'd love for you to tell us not just like in general about what a pulsar is, but also what these very special species of pulsar, these millisecond pulsars that we use for pulsar timing, can you tell us a little bit about them in particular and what makes them special as far as pulsars go?
Absolutely. I'd be more than happy to do that. Pulsars are my whole thing, and so I'd love to talk about them. Pulsars are neutron stars. They're these highly magnetized, rapidly rotating neutron stars that beam radiation out of their magnetic axes. And so as they spin around, there's these sort of lighthouses almost. And so when the beam sweeps across our line of sight, if the geometry, if the orientation is right, then we'll see sort of a pulsating signal as that neutron star rotates. And so that's why they're called pulsars. They only appear to pulse. They don't, intrinsically pulse. But outside of just these sort of normal pulsars, there's a special class called millisecond pulsars. And so these rotate at millisecond rotational rates, right? So just sort of unbelievably fast. It's a neutron star the size of a city. It's spinning around at the speed of a kitchen blender. It's really mind-blowing. This is sort of my whole thing, and I still can't really, really appreciate what's happening at these millisecond pulsars. They're just so mind-blowing. And so the millisecond pulsars are sort of counterintuitively a much older class of pulsar than the sort of young normal pulsars. They have been spun up by a binary companion, by accreting matter from a companion. And so after this sort of evolutionary process happens, you end up with an old pulsar that's spinning at very, very high frequencies, in orbit, usually with something like a white dwarf companion. And so the really great thing about millisecond pulsars is that through this recycling process, we call it recycling when it accretes all that material and spins up, they've actually become very steady rotators. And so that's what makes them such fantastic clocks. And that's really why for this kind of work, for very, very high precision pulsar timing, we are looking for millisecond pulsars that have really steady rotational rates. So they're just sort of these mind-blowing objects. And for pulsar timing array work, we're a little bit picky actually about which ones we use, because we really just need the best space clocks we can find. And so even though it's very important to time as many as we can, we have to really be careful about which ones we're choosing to include in the array. It's a very interesting optimization problem, but it's definitely a really difficult one too. But the millisecond pulsars, just in and of themselves, are very cool objects. And the fact that we can use them both to detect gravitational waves, right, in, as a part of pulsar timing array experiments, but also then have these amazingly rich data sets that are just us being able to time tons of millisecond pulsars over decades at very, very high cadences, right, at least monthly, is very cool too, because we can learn a lot about the pulsars themselves. And so it's really an experiment that comes with a ton of benefits on the side.
You know, I remember the way my advisor explained millisecond pulsars to me when I was in graduate school, and he was telling me that these are the most precise clocks in the universe except for atomic clocks, that you can look at a millisecond pulsar, and if you measure its pulse period for long enough and it's steady enough, that you can basically look away from a millisecond pulsar for a year. And you can look back and know whether 10 billion pulses have passed or 10 billion and one pulses have passed by the time you look back again. And that type of precision, I think, is actually underestimating it, because I believe we can get precisions to like one part in 10 to the 17 with millisecond pulsars, at least with the best millisecond pulsars. But every once in a while, one of these millisecond pulsars that has been steady and steadily pulsing away for years or even decades, it can undergo what's called a glitch. And I don't think this is like, Princess Vanellope from the Wreck-It Ralph movie. I think this is more like, I guess I think of it in terms of the way that I think whenever you have an earthquake on Earth, you're actually slightly changing the rotational period of Earth, because when you're rearranging the mass around a spinning object, you're changing its moment of inertia. And because angular momentum is conserved, when you change how its mass is distributed, you're also changing its rotational rate. And I've always thought of these glitches as, oh, that's probably a star quake happening on these neutron stars where it's rearranging their moment of inertia. And I apologize if this is a naive question, but do we have any better insight into what these glitches are? And are any of the millisecond pulsars that you're using to look for these gravitational waves, to sort of measure the ticking of clocks in the universe, have any of them glitched? And what do you do about it when they do?
Yeah, so this exactly comes to the point I made about the sources we're choosing. We're very picky about them, right? So it ends up being the case that we're actually picking a pretty boring set of millisecond pulsars to include in our array. And so we really don't, you know, glitches are relatively rare in millisecond pulsars. They're nothing like the sort of young population of pulsars that I talked about before. And so we really are trying to avoid including sources in the array that are showing abnormal behaviors like that. And so in that way, pulsar timing array experiments aren't particularly capable of kind of providing insight into those kinds of events. Those are far more suited for sort of pulsar observing projects, but not necessarily ones that have to do with pulsar timing array experiments. There are, you know, some interesting things that happen with our pulsars. For example, J1713 is a pulsar that is sort of one of the most important for pulsar timing rays in the area of the sky that we can observe in Nanograv and the European Pulsar Timing Array and other collaborations. So it's a very precise timer, but a few years ago, it actually underwent what's called a profile change. So pulsars are kind of interesting in that every individual pulse can look a little bit different, but over time, once you integrate up, you know, thousands of these pulses, they actually have very stable profiles. And so that little pulsating signal that you might associate with a pulsar, that shape, generally speaking, will stay pretty consistent over time. And it does change as a function of frequency. So the profile will look a little bit different at lower observing frequencies than it does at higher observing frequencies. But over time, they tend to stay pretty normal. But for 1713, it scared us a little bit recently when our collaborators all over the world, and also with instruments that we use in NanoGrap, we all saw that 1713's profile changed. And that really sort of isn't supposed to happen. And so it sparked a bunch of very intensive observing campaigns. We saw that the profile did actually return to how it was before this event happened over a fairly long time span. And so now it is looking relatively normal. But that's the sort of thing that we don't want to time a bunch of pulsars that are throwing surprises like this at us. But it's also, it's scientifically extremely interesting. But it's also, it's not going to sink sort of our experiment in any way. One of the things that I like to talk about is the fact that the gravitational wave signals that we're sensitive to have this very, very distinctive correlation pattern. So the correlations that we're looking for that are between all of the different pulsars in the array that we time, these very subtle changes in the time of arrival of the pulses that's correlated in a very specific way according to general relativity, that sort of signal is really hard to duplicate, right? And it's not the kind of thing that's going to be induced by a single profile change event like the one I described in 1713. It's the sort of thing that's really hard to mock in any other way. So we even know if there's something like a monopolar signal being induced in our correlations between the pulsars, right? So that would be something like a clock error, just a small linear change with time, a little, I guess, a glitch in our clock, if you want to put it that way. That would induce a very specific sort of change, a monopolar change. There are things like the solar system ephemeris that we use to account for the positions of all the planets in the solar system and their masses and things like that. We're actually sensitive enough with these pulsar timing array experiments that it matters to us if we know the position of Jupiter well enough, right? And so that sort of a deviation can induce a signal that is dipolar, but they're not mocking this quadrupolar signal that we expect to see. And so in that way, we have sort of a backup, sort of some reassurance that even if there are these interesting things happening with our pulsars, they're not necessarily going to manifest as, a fake gravitational wave background or something like that.
No, that's really great to know that, look, some of these objects are doing interesting things, and some of that interesting behavior is really not what you want to see if you're trying to measure this gravitational wave signal. But also, we have enough good, steady, stable pulsars that have been observed well enough for long enough that even if one of them starts doing something weird or a few of them start doing something weird, that's not really going to substantially degrade the quality of the science that we're doing or undermine the confidence we have in what we're seeing from the data that we actually have. To ask you something a little more general about pulsars and neutron stars, I'm aware that most of the neutron stars that we know of aren't pulsing, or at least aren't pulsing where we can see them. If I imagine that these neutron stars are like, they're like planet Earth, they're like a super shrunk down, dense, more massive version of planet Earth in the sense that they spin on their axis. But here on Earth, we know our magnetic axis is not really perfectly aligned with our rotational axis. So if we had material around us that we could accelerate with our magnetic fields, Earth would pulse. In fact, I think they've even seen pulsing white dwarfs before, that it's not even just neutron stars that pulse, that we've seen pulsing white dwarfs also. Is it possible, or is it even likely, that most or even all neutron stars do in fact pulse? It's just that the ones that we observe as pulsars are just the ones whose magnetic axis, whose radio pulses happen to bip by us and bip, bip, bip every single time they rotate on their axis and that beam passes by our eyes? And does this mean that maybe some of the pulsars we're seeing today won't be pulsing at us in the future, and some of the pulsars that aren't pulsing at us today will become detectable pulsars to us in the future?
Yeah, so that's a really interesting question. And I mean, some folks do think that all neutron stars at some point are behaving as pulsars, right? So this happens once you have the collapse of a star whose mass is sort of large enough to end up going through core collapse supernova and birthing a neutron star. So those collapse events impart, a spin onto the neutron star. And so it's possible that, all neutron stars at some point have been a pulsar, but we do also know that the very energetic ones, the ones that haven't had that opportunity to be recycled, so not sort of the old millisecond pulsar population, those do spin down with time. And so it's very possible, we know that there are a lot of kind of dead pulsars, right, all over the universe, that aren't necessarily going to get spun back up or anything exciting like that. And so there are definitely tons of neutron stars that we just won't ever be able to see. And the rate at which that spin down occurs is pretty fast for the younger population, and it's relatively slow, right, for the ones that have gone through the spinning up, the recycling process. But I would say it's more likely that in the future there are many that we can see now that we will no longer be able to see, given the assumption that the Earth is still here and all of those things. It's a little bit hard to know, right? Because we really are biased by the population that we can see that's sort of geometrically favorable, where we can actually see that pulsation, that beam sweeping across our line of sight. So it's a little bit of a hard question to answer, but we definitely know that there are many that maybe were pulsars that aren't anymore.
Well, let me ask you then a different version of this question that you might feel more comfortable providing a more definitive answer to. Let's say it's tens of thousands of years from now, and some intelligent extraterrestrial civilization finds Voyager 1, finds the Voyager 1 probe, and sees the golden record, and actually figures out, oh, look at these cute little Earthlings from 1977 sending out a map of where pulsars were at that moment in time. Is there any chance that they would be able to use that map and say, oh yeah, here's where all those pulsars are? Or is there almost no chance that that alien civilization would actually be able to find those neutron stars and would actually see them pulsing?
Yeah, so I'm embarrassed to say that I actually am not sure of the math off the top of my head. But what I would say is it depends on which pulsars were shown on the Voyager map. And it depends on how fast they're spinning down, right? And so I think it's very possible that on the timescales you're talking about, that many of them will still be pulsars. But I would have to run the numbers, and I don't have them in front of me, which is quite embarrassing. I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. But I'm assuming that the longer you wait, the harder it will be to reconstruct. And basically, if the aliens get to it faster, they'll have a better chance of figuring out what this was. And if they get to it later, they'll be like, well, that was a snapshot in time and space.
Yeah, that's true for sure. That's okay. Exactly right.
Well, thank you for that. One thing that I know you played a major role in is a few years ago, they announced the discovery of the most massive neutron star ever discovered. And I know this is not a millisecond pulsar. So if you're only listening to this for the millisecond pulsars, then this is going to bore you. But I think these things are interesting in their own right. And one of the big questions we've had for a long time is, how massive can a neutron star get before turning into a black hole. And I was surprised to learn that from a theoretical perspective, that answer might be different for a neutron star that forms from the core collapse of a massive star versus for a neutron star that forms from, say, the merger of two lower mass stellar remnants. And so I'm sort of curious, like you found, I believe it was about a 2.2 solar mass neutron star. And I know there's a theoretical limit to how massive a neutron star can get before, you know, it just collapses into a black hole. And that also depends somewhat on how fast the neutron star is spinning. So, for instance, I know LIGO found a neutron star merger that added up to somewhere around 2¾ solar masses. And for a little while, for like maybe just a little less than a second, that 2.7 solar mass thing stayed as a neutron star before collapsing into a black hole. But when they saw two slightly more massive neutron stars merge, with a total mass of about 3.4 solar masses, that thing went right to a black hole. So I'm a little curious, with this most massive neutron star, most massive stable neutron star that's been seen to date, do we think that this is close to the maximum possible mass you can get for a neutron star? And at some point, do we expect that, yeah, like once such and such process happens, you can't make a neutron star anymore, it won't be stable, and you have to make a black hole?
Yeah, so actually, I'll go back first to the beginning of the question, and I hope that the people who are millisecond pulsar enthusiasts haven't actually logged off yet, because JO740 plus 6620, which is this object you're talking about, that we measured the mass of a few years ago, it actually is a millisecond pulsar.
Oh, boom!
It has a rotational rate of something. Yeah, it's even cooler than maybe you would have thought before. But it has a rotational rate of about 2.9 milliseconds, so extremely fast, right? So a few years ago, we did a study of JO740 plus 6620, which is this millisecond pulsar that's actually part of the Nanograph dataset. And so we used about, you know, 4 or 5 years of Nanograph data, and then additionally observed the pulsar at parts of its orbital period. And I can go into this more if you'd like, and maybe I just will, and you can stop me at any time. But basically, the reason why we can measure the masses of these millisecond pulsars or these pulsars is because they show a very specific general relativistic effect. In this case, it's called Shapiro delay. So this is what happens when you have a system that's very edge-on. And so when the pulsar goes behind its companion, in the case of 0740, that's a white dwarf companion. When it goes behind its companion, the mass of that companion is going to deform spacetime and sort of make the pulse arrive much later than you would have expected otherwise. And so it causes this spike in the timing. And so that spike, being able to characterize it with what we call Shapiro delay parameters, right, lets us break the degeneracy in the Keplerian mass function and lets us measure the mass of the pulsar and its companion independently in a way where we could have only put sort of a limit on the mass otherwise. And so it's this very powerful technique, but it's one that's only able to be done in a very small subset of sources. They really have to be edge-on in this very perfect way. So the first time this was done, the first sort of two solar mass neutron star that we saw was from Demarest et al. In 2010. This was another Nanograph source, actually, that we still time today. And this was a big deal because we hadn't seen any neutron stars that massive before. It was nearly two solar masses. And so exactly like what you already said, I mean, being able to find more and more massive neutron stars lets us try to learn something about that mass that we don't really know yet, but the mass where a neutron star would become too massive and would need to be a black hole, right? And so, you know, a little bit like the Chandrasekhar mass, there's this Tolman-Oppenheimer-Volkov mass that is the line between neutron stars and black holes, and we really don't know where it is. And so one of the sort of easiest ways to put a limit on the different theories, to constrain the different theories for exactly what nuclear physics is going on in the deep interior of these neutron stars, putting a limit on that can be done just by measuring more and more massive neutron stars, right? Because each of those proposals, each of those equations of state, as we call them, will predict that massive collapse. And so if we see something that's more massive than the predicted mass for collapse, then we know that that theory has to be adjusted a little bit in order to account for a neutron star that massive. And so originally with 0740 plus 6620, we reported the mass to be 2.14 plus or minus 0.1 solar masses. And so quite massive, the most massive neutron star that had been measured to that date. But with fairly large error bars, to be totally honest, right? And so this was very exciting. But we've been doing more and more observations of it, right? It's still part of the NanoGrab observing program. And there was a study led by my colleague, Emmanuel Fonseca, and many, many of our mutual colleagues in 2021 that refined the mass down to 2.08 solar masses. And so, you know, it's not quite that flashy 2.2 or 2.3 solar mass number that would be so exciting to see. And I certainly hope that we will keep being able to study more and more massive neutron stars that really are hitting what might be that upper limit. But it's a little bit hard to tell now. And I think that, you know, there is that mass gap and there is sort of this no man's land where pulsar timing, you know, radio observations and even like X-ray observations of neutron stars, things like that, aren't quite getting up to those masses. And then experiments that are able to put constraints on the equation of state in other ways, like through tidal deformability, which you already mentioned, are sort of not able to constrain it either, or can put different kinds of limits on that mass. And so I think we just have to do more and more observations. But it is a little bit of a frustrating problem, because it would be really nice to better nail down where that line can be drawn. But it's really hard, and it's something that just can't, you know, there are experiments on Earth that help us sort of learn more about the nuclear physics involved. But it's sort of an experiment that just intrinsically has to be done in space.
Well, that's one of the big problems with being an astronomer or an astrophysicist, is you don't get to do the laboratory experiments because you don't control the laboratory. The universe is your laboratory, and it's big and it's full of stuff. So there are lots of experiments that are just kind of naturally being performed out there, but you have to be lucky enough to get the right configuration that's visible to you for you to see it. This reminds me a lot, actually, of exoplanet science, that the first exoplanets we were able to detect through this technique that we used to call stellar wobble, and you probably learned as radial velocity, where you basically take the parent star and you sort of see how is this parent star moving towards us and away from us periodically in the sky, and that allows you to infer, oh, there's a planet orbiting it, and the planet has these orbital parameters, and you can do that up to a point. You can do that up to what they call M sine I, which means you can get sort of mass of the planet multiplied by this factor you don't know, which is the sine, if you remember trigonometry, of the angle that the planet is orbiting its star at relative to your line of sight. And that angle is random. that angle is randomly distributed. And it sounds like you're saying, hey, we found a millisecond pulsar that was basically aligned so perfectly edge on to us that we were able to sort of go and measure like, oh, now it's in front of the star and I don't see the gravitational effects of the star in front of it. But then it goes behind the star and I do see what we call the Shapiro time delay or the gravitational time delay of the pulses from being back there. And it sounds that this is just like that scenario where, oh, we do have a radial velocity for this exoplanet, but we also have a transit. And so we know it's edge on or super close to edge on, so we can actually say, oh, now I know the mass of the exoplanet. And in this case, it sounds like, we can use that plus the orbital properties plus the amount of the time delay that tells us the mass of the companion, and that's how we get the mass of the pulsar. So it sounds like you just need to find sort of that right version out there of, we have a very massive neutron star with a companion, and that neutron star is pulsing, and it happens to be oriented edge on to us. And it sounds like this, I'm sorry, now 2.08 solar mass neutron star is the most massive one you've found in this configuration so far.
Yeah, that's totally correct. And it really is a little bit of a game of luck, right? Because we have to have these things in order to break that degeneracy that I mentioned. And so we have to have a system that's very, very close to edge on. We have to have it sort of set up in a way where we see a significant Shapiro time delay, and that induces a change in our timing residuals that's actually measurable. A lot of systems might show sort of a very marginal kind of detection of Shapiro delay, or they do show Shapiro delay and it's just not that massive, a neutron star or something like that. And so we really do have to be lucky in that way. But there are other ways of probing the masses of neutron stars, right? There are some recent results that use completely different methods, like studying systems, we call them black widow systems. So these are these highly accelerated binary neutron star pairs, or not pairs of neutron stars, but neutron stars with a companion. And so those are not quite as cut and dry as the radio timing derived masses that we get. But there are a lot of different ways of doing this. Also, I have many colleagues who work for example, with the instrument NICER, the Neutron Star Interior Composition Explorer, which is mounted on the ISS. It's this awesome X-ray telescope. And that is able to constrain the equation of state in a slightly different way because they're sensitive to the ratio between the mass and the radius of the neutron star. It's actually an extremely cool thing. They're seeing these hot spots that are, the photons are going to be affected by the extreme compactness of the neutron star. And so they're seeing it in a totally different way. But they're able to constrain the equation of state from sort of a different part of parameter space. And it's very cool because we can actually work together. So through these radio observations, which are only able to constrain the mass of the neutron star, right? We're not sensitive to the radius of the neutron star at all. But then our colleagues who are working with instruments like NICER are able to constrain the mass and the radius of the neutron star. And so if we can better inform their mass measurements, then they get a much better grip on what the actual radius is. And so this constrains the equation of state in a different way. And at this point, I think I've been rambling and forgot the rest of the question, so I apologize for that.
No, this is great because you've talked about so many interesting things that I just have more questions. So let me sort of ask you some of them. What I know with white dwarfs, one of the paradoxical things that happens is the more massive a white dwarf gets, the smaller it gets, that gravitational compression is actually a greater effect than the fact that you've got more material that takes up more volume, and so the smallest white dwarfs are actually the most massive ones. Is this something that we know the answer for with neutron stars? As we up the mass of a neutron star, does a neutron star physically get bigger, or does it physically get smaller?
So this is sort of, this is beyond, behind the entire question of what the equation of state for neutron star interiors actually is. And so because we don't know it very well, the relationship between, you know, pressure and density within the neutron star is the equation of state. And that's going to change depending on how you think the interiors of the neutron stars are behaving. And so we have evidence as we observe more and more massive neutron stars, we're able to sort of put a limit on the softer equations of state that sort of involve more exotic proposals for the nuclear physics that's going on. And so we actually think that we are seeing larger neutron stars that with a stiffer equation of state. But this is something that we are trying to answer by probing the equation of state of neutron star matter. And so the exact relationship, I think, will depend on what we find. But in general, we think that the equation of state describing the matter is going to be a stiffer one.
Okay. I know that when you talk about improving the accuracy, like the timing accuracy, you're talking about saying, okay, if I take a millisecond pulsar and I look at some pulses and I look away and then I look at some pulses later, I can roughly predict the pulse arrival time to about a microsecond. That's about the best you can do these days. And that's great because if anything causes a pulse delay or speed up of a microsecond or more, now you can detect it in your signals. You talked about how, well, look, you really need the right, really almost perfectly edge-on system to detect a Shapiro time delay for a pulsar. But if you could get that down from microsecond precision down to, say, nanosecond precision, what would that open up? If we could vastly improve how precisely we could measure and know the pulse arrival time, are these millisecond pulsars good enough clocks that we could suddenly start, you know, doing additional science that right now is beyond the limits of our precision?
Yeah, absolutely. So you perfectly described kind of the process of pulsar timing, which is just this idea that we can predict the time of arrival of every single pulse from the pulsar, right? And how well we can do that is this timing precision that you're talking about. And we actually exceed 1 microsecond. The 1 microsecond number we throw around as kind of the limit that we want to put on the pulsars that we include in pulsar timing array experiments, just because, you know, the pulsars that we can time better than a microsecond are going to be the ones that help us the most in growing sensitivity to the background. But we can, you know, especially with next generation instruments, things like Meerkat, the sort of precision with which you can time pulsars with an instrument like, you know, the GVT, definitely, like Meerkat, like FAST, can be significantly better than that. And if we can keep developing this instrumentation, if we can keep developing our timing techniques such that we're reaching better and better timing precisions, that's going to impact a bunch of different kind of side projects that you can do with pulsars, right? So this is going to impact how well we can measure the mass of millisecond pulsars. In some cases, in a limited number of cases, which is fantastic. Though when you talk about the sort of constraints that you can put on the equation of state, you really need very massive sources. And that's something that we don't have a ton of control over. But being able to better measure the mass would be fantastic. Also, when you're just talking about pulsar timing array experiments, I mean, improving the timing precision is absolutely critical. It impacts everything that we can do by timing millisecond pulsars. And it just, you know, millisecond pulsar timing has so many applications that there are almost too many to count. But improving timing precision will impact all of those.
Okay, I'm going to ask you a question now, and it's going to seem like it comes out of left field, but I will fess up to you and our audience that I had this idea the summer after I finished my PhD, and it was the first paper I ever wrote up after graduating, that, hey, if we can get our pulsar timing to any millisecond pulsar that's far enough away, precisely enough, then what we should be able to do is look for dark matter substructure within our own galaxy transiting across our line of sight. Because unlike gas or dust or normal matter, a gravitational delay from something that was passing across or near your line of sight would be frequency independent. Its effects would affect all frequencies equally instead of being either bluer or redder like intervening matter is. And if your halo of dark matter was diffuse enough, you should be able to say, oh, well, if that's passing through my line of sight, I can tell this apart from, say, a rogue black hole or something like that, because it actually has a density profile to it. Do you think that with some of these new instruments coming online, that this would be something that could potentially be detectable? Would pulsar timing be a potentially useful technique to actually help investigate the structural nature of dark matter within our own galaxy?
Yeah, so it's not even a question out of left field, really. And I'll provide the caveat that this is absolutely not my area of expertise. So don't you know, just take what I'm saying with a grain of salt, I guess. But I do know that that idea absolutely is interesting to many folks who are involved in pulsar timing experiments. And so there have actually been sort of limits on fuzzy dark matter that have been placed using pulsar timing array data from many of the different collaborations within the IPTA. And my intuition is that those sorts of constraints will only improve as instrumentation improves. But in terms of sort of a solid number or metric for that improvement, I'm not really sure. But I think that that is a really sort of exciting application of pulsar timing as well, and one that folks might not think about immediately.
Well, you know, not everyone studies dark matter for a living, but you know, this is some exciting stuff. Where, you know, this, I remember Joseph Taylor commented on this idea when I proposed it, and he said, like, oh yeah, it's an interesting idea, but it's way beyond our current precision. And now I think if you're talking about, hey, maybe in the not too distant future, maybe before we're all dead, we actually will be able to measure some millisecond pulsars down to nanosecond pulse arrival precision. Maybe if you can do that for a decade or two, you might actually see one of these things go by through your line of sight. And look, any clues we can get about dark matter, I think we'd all be all for it.
Absolutely. I think that's 100% correct. And obviously, improvements in instrumentation are going to help in a number of applications. And I think this one in particular might get a big benefit from improving our pulsar timing precision with better instrumentation.
Well, fantastic. I'm so happy that you came on this podcast and basically gave us a grand tour of the gravitational wave universe that can be picked up by a network of almost perfect clocks, and that you told us about these almost perfect clocks, these millisecond pulsars, and taught us a whole lot about what they're used for and where we can hope to find them and how they came to be. This has been a really fascinating exploration of this branch of astrophysics to me. And before we end the show, I'd love to ask you, if you have any final thoughts you'd like to share with our listeners.
Sure. So I have a few different thoughts, and I'll try not to talk forever, but I think one of the really interesting things with these pulsar timing array experiments is just the fact that we're kind of using astrophysical objects as tools. And I just think that that idea that we can use this collection of millisecond pulsars that are naturally occurring, right? We didn't launch them into space. We didn't build a special instrument except for the radio telescopes that we use to observe them. They really were just sort of waiting there for us to use them as a gravitational wave detector. And so I think that that idea is just so neat, and I would love to hear about more sort of applications in astronomy, and I know they exist, of kind of using astrophysical objects as tools, because I think that that's really neat. I think the other thing that I would want to emphasize is just that all of the results coming out of these various pulsar timing array collaborations, I think, are just kind of a testament to the power of international collaboration. And I think that we'll see as we go forward the importance of that kind of collaboration to really achieving monumental scientific results. The other thing is that I know that there are so many students without whom this work would be absolutely impossible. And so just the idea that so many students contributed to this work that really did make a big splash. Every person in the collaboration is important, and their contributions are important. And so I hope that seeing these large collaborations have exciting moments like this will be inspirational to students, because every contribution really, really is critical. And you know, nothing's perfect, but we do what we can to sort of make the collaborations inclusive, doing our best in that way, making students feel like their contributions do matter. And I think that these splashy results are sort of a testament to that.
And just so our listeners know about this, what was your status professionally when you joined the NanoGrav collaboration? Were you, in fact, still a student?
Yeah, absolutely. So I joined NanoGrav at the beginning of graduate school, and I had sort of, this is off topic, I guess a little bit, but I had a little bit of a strange entrance into physics. I started college as a journalism major. I never took any kind of physical sciences in high school and was completely disinterested, and then jumped to astrophysics sort of randomly as an undergrad. But I really fell in love with pulsars at the end of at the end of undergraduate, as an REU student at Arecibo, actually. And so I knew that when I went to grad school, what I wanted to do was study millisecond pulsars. And I joined the NanoGrav collaboration pretty shortly after I started grad school, I think about a year or so. And so that was I became a member in 2015. I had gone to a meeting in 2014. But I really was at the very beginning of graduate school when I started in NanoGrav. And so it's been a really cool experience to sort of almost grow up as a scientist in this collaboration. It's been really cool to have such a supportive environment. Definitely the reason why I stuck around is because I had so many amazing colleagues who were willing to help me at every turn. And so getting involved in those big collaborations, you know, I really hope that students are able to find those kinds of supportive environments. And I feel extremely lucky to have done so so early in my career.
Well, thank you for sharing that wonderful personal story about yourself, which is precisely the opposite of my career path, where I got a PhD in astrophysics and never took a journalism class, and look at me now. So here's us living opposite sides of the same coin, and you can too. Well, thank you, everyone, for listening. I'd love to thank our sponsor, Avenues Online, the virtual campus of Avenues the World School, for sponsoring our episode. Again, you can learn more about them at avenues.org/SWAB. I'd love to alert everyone to an ongoing project that we are kickstarting right now called the Encyclopedia Cosmologica, which you can check out on Kickstarter. We are telling the story of the history history of the universe, one page and 100 million years at a time. We're going to start from before the Big Bang, and each time you turn the page, you will get a story of what's happening in the universe, a list of vital statistics about the universe, including what's in it, and you will be getting a unique new piece of art composed either by Mark Garlick or John Lomberg, who are two of the greatest space artists living today. Check out the Encyclopedia Cosmologica. And lastly, I'd like to thank our Patreon supporters, without whom this podcast would not be possible. I'd like to verbally shout out everyone who donates at the $5 a month level and above. So thanks go to Chad Marler, Jeff Bonwick, Lainey Chuist, Rob Hansen, Samir Kumar, Tim Graham, Aaron Weiss, Chris Chikutas, John Mithat, John Van Balaguyen, Matt Conroe, Pattern Shift, Pete Smoyer, Pierre Franson, C. Green Mango, Stefan Bernegger, William Blair, Amira Sosnick, Andy and Wall, Benish Tech LLC, Brian Terry, David Charney, George Church, John Kozura, Joseph Dvorak, Kiliaopu, Mark Armstrong, Matt Glasser, Patrick Dennis, Pedro Teixeira, Rafal Wojcik, Randall Slimak, Rick DeWitt, Robert Thibodeau, Ron Schiffman, Sean Foley, Steve Guderian, Adam Robinson, Adrian Griffiths, Alan Parikh, Andres Chovanec, Arnulfo Zepeda, Benhead, Bob Shire, Brainwise, Brett Minder, Cameron Sowards, Carl Ittings, Casey Haskins, Dan Steelen, Dana Bridges, David Hibbets, David Taschioni, David Wolk, Diana Nevins, Dick Pills, Dwayne Williams, Flo, Fraser Kane, Girolamo Castaldo, Glenn McDavid, Ira Cohen, James Bryson Hyatt, James Nance, James Page, Jason Luttrell, Jason McCampbell, Javier Zazo, Kelly Kudrick, Lockwood Carlson, Mark Bergeron, Mark Bloor, Mark Langston, Matt Reno, Michael Hall, Michael Savuto, Naked Bunny with a Whip, Nathan Hanna, Neil Flood, Owen Mam, Pam Harris, Paul Lester, Pavel Zuzelski, Philip Francis, Rich Weigel, Richard Schwartz, Ron Lyle, Rushin Shah, Sam Terzakian, Steve Nordhoff, Stuart Lending, Tom Van Scotter, Tomas Alt, Tomas Walgren, Wayne Pierkarski, Weller Tractor Salvage, William Vandenhuvel, and Young Co. S. Thanks to all of you for tuning in, and I'll see you back here next time for more Starts With a Bang.